All right, is everyone there? We want to pick up where we left off from last week. We left off in Deuteronomy chapter 20, all right? And we're just going to delve right into it. God's dealing with some various laws and ordinances that he sets forth in regards to what they're going to encounter when they get into their new land. But again, you know, I can't emphasize this enough when we go through the Old Testament, because especially for anybody who might be new here tonight, when we read everything that Moses has written in the first five books of the Bible, it's really known as the law of God, okay? That was given to Moses, and he's, of course, written it down, and we have it thousands of years later. And a lot of what is written there, okay, does not apply to us today. However, it all had its fulfillment in Jesus Christ, and it all has a spiritual principle that can be applied today. And I always got to emphasize that, especially for any new people, because you always go back to Galatians chapter 3. This is what Paul says, the New Testament. He says, "Why the law then? It was added because of transgressions, having been ordained through the angels by the agency of a mediator until the seed should come to whom the promise had been made." The seed, of course, Jesus Christ. "Now a mediator is not for one party only, whereas God is only one. Is the law then contrary to the promises of God? May it never be. For if the law had been given which was able to impart life, then righteousness would indeed have been based on law." In other words, if we could have been saved by keeping the law, then Jesus Christ would never have had to come. But he says here, "But Scripture has shut up all men under sin, that the promise by faith in Jesus Christ might be given to those who believe. But before faith came, we were kept in custody under the law." I want to repeat that, because this is what I'm talking about here. Before faith came, we were kept in the custody under the law, being shut up to the faith which was later to be revealed. Therefore, the law has become our tutor to teach us and to lead us to Christ, that we may be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. So this is my point, and I think it's very, we almost always have to do this when you're reading the various laws of Moses, especially all these different ceremonial laws. They still have an application, but they all pointed to Jesus, and they had their fulfillment in Jesus. So when you're reading something that Moses has written a thousands of years ago, and it really seems strange, you always got to stop and say, okay, now what's the spiritual principle here? How is this pointed to Jesus Christ? How did it have its fulfillment in him? Because it all has a spiritual significance to it. And beginning with that verse 1 in chapter 20 of Deuteronomy, it says, "When you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God who brought you up from the land of Egypt is with you. Now it shall come about that when you are approaching the battle, the priest shall come near and speak to the people, and he shall say to them, 'Hear, O Israel, you are approaching the battle against your enemies today. Do not be faint-hearted, do not be afraid or panic or tremble before them. Since for the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you. The officers also shall speak to the people, saying, 'Who is the man who has built a new house and who has not dedicated it? Let him depart and return to his house, lest he die in battle and another man dedicate it. And who is the man that has planted a vineyard and has not begun to use his fruit? Let him depart and return to his house, lest he die in battle and another man begin to use his fruit. And who is the man that is engaged to a woman and has not married her? Let him depart and return to his house, lest he die in battle and another man marry her.' Then the officers shall speak further to the people, and they shall say, 'Who is the man who is afraid and faint-hearted? Let him depart and return to his house, so that he may not make his brother's heart melt like his heart.' And it shall come about that when the officers have finished speaking to the people, they shall appoint commanders of armies at the head of the people." Now, here's, you know, I think some very interesting things that God has set forth in this book of Deuteronomy. And it's talking about when you go to battle. Now, he's talking about, you know, some of the prerequisites that are going to be applied here are some of the things that God is going to require. And first of all, we've got to ask ourselves, okay, well, how does this apply to us today? I mean, what's the spiritual significance? And we got to understand that if you go back to Ephesians chapter 6, this is where what it's all about in terms of what we are engaged in right now. We are engaged in a spiritual battle. We are engaged in a fight for our very souls, for our, you know, our eternal lives in a sense. Because Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 6, he says, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places," or high places. "Therefore, take up the full armor of God, that you may be able to resist in the evil day, having done everything to stand firm." And then he goes on and he lists a number of things that we have to do, you know, in this spiritual battle. You know, put on the helmet of salvation, okay, the breastplate of righteousness, gird your loins with truth. He says, "Shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace, take up the sword of the Spirit," you know, "take up the shield of faith." We are in a battle here. We are really in a knockdown, drag out spiritual battle with the forces of darkness. And what we read here, even though, you know, this was written thousands of years ago, we may read this and say, "Hey, this has no relevance for us today." But I'm telling you, it does. It has a great deal of significance for us today, because if you look at what he's saying here, he says, when you go up against your enemies, okay, first of all, make the application now. Our enemies are who? Our enemies are basically the world, the flesh, and the devil, all right? And all these powers of darkness that are just absolutely hell-bent on destroying every human being they possibly can. If they can't drag them to hell, they're going to try to destroy their life in one way, or shape, or form, or another. And we are in a conflict with him. There's no question about it. But he's saying this. When you're going to go to battle, he says in that verse 2, "Now it shall come about that when you are approaching the battle, the priest shall come near and speak to the people." So, in other words, when you go into conflict with the devil, with the power of darkness, you really got to understand that this is really spiritual in nature. In other words, they got to go to the priest, all right? And he's the one that's supposed to intercede and pray on behalf of the army, basically for their victory. And, you know, this is one thing that when we're fighting and contending with these forces of darkness, I mean, we really have to be in prayer. There's no question about it. You just can't expect to do battle with the forces of darkness without a great deal of prayer, a great deal of study and preparation. Or, you know, you just can't go through shooting from the hip. And for whatever you do, you can't be living in sin and go up against the powers of darkness, because they've got you by the throat. You've got to be right with God. That's why the priest, you know, is the one who basically is supposed to intercede for them before they go to battle. But he says, don't be faint-hearted, don't be afraid or panic or tremble before them. Okay, now here's the thing. We're no match for the powers of darkness. There's no question about it. But Jesus did say this, "Stronger is he who is in you than he who is in the world." All right? And so, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I don't know how many thousands of Bible studies I've taught over the years, but very often, before I'll begin a Bible study, I mean, the day of the Bible study, the devil will be attacking me one way, shape, or form or another. Guarantee it. All right? If it ain't one way, it's another way. If it ain't another way, it's a different way. I mean, he's always going to try to just throw some monkey wrench into my trying to come up against him with God's word and trying to feed God's sheep and try to, you know, inspire people to get right with God. And this especially applies to the retreat. I mean, when I go up to the retreat, man, I do a lot of praying and even fasting, and I do a lot of preparation and everything. I just, everything I possibly can to bind the devil and, you know, forces of darkness. And when I'm up there, man, I just pray that I don't let my guard down one minute, because I know that he will get his foot in the door. I just know it from experience and what he's doing. And we had a really good retreat this past time. I mean, we had, you know, all kinds of people turning their lives over to Christ or rededicating their lives. And, you know, I come off that mountain and I felt that God really blessed it. And next thing I know, the devil kicks me in the face because somebody goes out and steals my car in front of my house. I got all my Bibles in there and books and tapes and all this stuff. And it's like, you know, I get up and I leave my house at 17 after 5 in the morning to go to work. I'm out there to go to work, all dressed for work, and no car. You know, right off the bat, I lose a whole day's wage. And then, I, you know, the whole hassle of everything. And long story short, they find my car a few days later sitting over there. I think it's in North Highlands or whatever. And when I finally got to see my car, they had wrecked the car. Inside, they looked like they tried to light it on fire, and I had a fire extinguisher in my trunk, and it looked like they sprayed the whole inside. I couldn't get a key in the ignition because they jammed a screwdriver in there or something. And, you know, the insurance company said, well, we just got to total it, okay? So they're giving me $2,100 for my car. So now I'm without a car, and I can't buy much for $2,100. But it was like, it was just the devil kicking me in the teeth. I know it. But at the same time, I feel like I was really grateful because my prayers were answered. I got almost all my books back and all my tapes back because that was really important to me. But I'm just saying, this is the battle that we're in. This is the warfare that we're in. This is the real war. This is the real battle. All the wars that are going on right now, I mean, there's over 40 wars that are going on in the world right now. All right, some of the worst wars that are happening are over there in Africa and the Sudan and the Congo and these other places. I mean, people are killing each other left and right, you know. But I'm telling you, that's not the real war. The real war is spiritual in nature. I mean, the devil's behind it all. So when God says, "Don't be afraid, don't tremble, don't panic," you know, you got to recognize, hey, if we panic, if we're afraid, if we back down, what does it show? It shows a lack of faith. Granted, I feel an apprehension a lot of times before I even teach a Bible study, but every time before I retreat, because I know what I'm dealing with. But I just feel like, hey, stronger is he that is in me than he's in the world. So I'm not going to be afraid. I'm not going to back down. I'm not going to be intimidated by him, because I know that you know, my faith tells me God is stronger. And so this is where the application is as far as these writings, what Moses is giving. But look what he also says here. In verse 4, "For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you." And then he says, "The officers also shall speak to the people, saying, 'Who is that man who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him depart and return to his house, lest he die in battle and another man dedicate it.'" He says, "And who is the man who has planted a vineyard and has not begun to use his fruit? Let him depart and return to his house, lest he die in battle and another man begin to use his fruit. And who is the man who is engaged to a woman and has not married her? Let him depart and return to his house, lest he die in battle and another man marry her." Now, this is interesting. I mean, you read the stipulations here that God actually allows certain situations and circumstances to kind of act as a deferment, or, you know, a person who can be exempt from military service for these reasons. And we will look at it on the surface and we could say, well, you know, God's concerned about people having fulfilled their heart's desire, which is true. Okay, you can make that application, but I really believe there's a much deeper and primary application, because if you read these various things, what it suggests to me is this. All right, when we're in this spiritual battle, God does not want us to be preoccupied with other things. Now, granted, we're living in the world. We have to be of the world in the sense that we all have our responsibilities, right? And obligations and everything like that. I'm not talking about that in this respect. When we're in this conflict, we're not to be distracted, all right? I mean, we're to give Christ our all. And a lot of these things can be a distraction where people will hold back and not give God their all in this conflict. So it's almost as though God, in a sense, a spiritual sense, is, hey, man, if you're going to be distracted, then you're not going to give it your best shot. You're not going to give it your all. And therefore, you're going to jeopardize the victory. I think that that really has a lot to say about that. And also, what he says here, I think, is also very significant, because he says in that verse 8, "Then the officers shall speak further to the people, and they shall say, 'Who is the man who is afraid and faint-hearted? Let him depart and return to his house, so that he might not make his brothers' hearts melt like his.'" Now, put two and two together. If a person who's afraid and faint-hearted, what does it show?
Lack of faith,
because we're told right up there in our verse 4 that the Lord God is the one who will fight for you and against your enemies. So if you really believe that with all your heart, then, okay, you might, just out of pure humanness, feel some apprehension going into battle. I mean, you would be a fool not to, but your faith is going to say, I'm going in anyway, because God's going to give us the victory. You see, now that's faith, right? I mean, same thing with these retreats. I mean, I always have an apprehension, but I'm just going to do it anyway, because I know that God is going to get the victory. God is the one who's doing the fighting. So he's basically saying, hey, if you're faint-hearted, you know, if you're scared, he says, we don't want you around. Why? Because you're going to affect other people. You know, in the spiritual warfare, I mean, you just don't need people that are lukewarm, apathetic, indifferent, or they're ashamed of Christ. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you don't need those kind of people by your side. You need the people who are going to be in step with you in terms of, hey, man, this is a spiritual battle, and we're going to be shoulder to shoulder against the spiritual forces of wickedness, and we just are totally sold out to Christ. That's, to me, is a spiritual principle. That's what the tutor, that's what the teacher is trying to tell us. And he says in that verse 9, he says, "And it shall come about that when the officers have finished speaking to the people, they shall appoint commanders of armies at the head of the people." Now, it says here, when the officers have finished, okay, speaking to the people, they're the ones that are to appoint the commanders, all right? And I think that has a very spiritual significance to it, because obviously, if they want to win this battle, they're going to pick out the cream of the crop in terms of their fighting ability to be the leaders. And I really think that that says a lot spiritually in terms of, okay, what you don't want to do is, you know, like Paul says, if there's a new convert, you don't want to put him in the pulpit. Why does he say that?
because he said he'll get puffed up, he'll get proud, and the devil could take him down. You know, you need somebody who's been around, somebody who's experienced, somebody, you know, who knows what they're up against, you know, in this spiritual battle to be the leaders. This is what he's talking about here. He says in that verse 10, he says, "And when you approach a city to fight against it, you shall offer it terms of peace. And it shall come about, if it agrees to make peace with you and opens to you, then it shall be that all the people who are found in it shall become your forced labor and shall serve you. However, if it does not make peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. When the Lord your God gives it into your hands, you shall strike all the men in it with the edge of the sword. Only the women and the children and the animals and all that is in the city and all the spoil you shall take as booty for yourself, and you shall use the spoil of your enemies which the Lord your God has given you. Thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you, which are not of the cities of the nations nearby. Only in the cities of these people that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes, but you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, as the Lord your God has commanded you, in order that they may not teach you to do according to all the detestable things which they have done for their gods, so that you would sin against the Lord your God." So basically what he's saying this, when you get into your land, and if you have a conflict with another nation that's not of Canaan, you know, if you're going to go to war with the Egyptians or the Ethiopians or, you know, the Assyrians or the Babylonians or whoever, all right, God is basically saying that, okay, first and foremost, you need to offer terms of peace, all right? And if they're not going to accept your terms of peace, then, you know, you're to besiege the city and the Lord will fight for you. And then once you destroy your enemies, he says that you'll destroy all the males, then you are allowed to take the women and children. Now, it doesn't say this here, but there's a suggestion when we read earlier where Moses allowed the returning armies that conquered the Midianites. Remember that? He said that you could go ahead and keep the women as long as they were virgins. Everyone else had to be killed. Now, we look at this, we say, what? Because it doesn't make any sense to us, especially as Christians. But we're thousands of years removed from this particular law. So, we have to ask, okay, what is our tutor trying to teach us? What is it trying to tell us? All right? Because it still has a spiritual application. Now, for the Christian, for example, bring it up to the modern day. Who are our enemies that we're going up against? I would say, for one, this group called the ACLU, you know, they are nothing but a band of hooligans, a bunch of God-haters that are just, they never pass up an opportunity to strengthen the hands of the wicked and to oppose the righteous. Now, those are our enemies, you know what I mean? And if we can't make peace with them, then we really got to confront them head on. All right. Look what happened this back in 1963 when this country just laid over, rolled over, and belched a little when this wicked, good-for-nothing woman named Madeline Marie O'Hare got God thrown out of our schools. Her and a bunch of worthless judges and lawyers. Now, when that happened, this country should have been up in arms, and we should have ran those judges, those lawyers, and that woman out of town on the rail. But no, what did we do? We let it happen. Now, 40 years later, 45 years later, look at the mess our schools are in, because we kicked God out of our schools, we kicked him out of our courts, we kicked him out of, you know, every public place. I mean, if you have a nativity scene somewhere, somebody's going to sue you and have a fit. I mean, this is where we are at, all right, because we don't stand up against evil. Yeah.
When you say that this nation should have stood up in arms and ran them out.
Well, I'm not talking get your machine guns and your bazookas. I mean, hey, stand up, okay, and fight these people with every legitimate means that we have possible. And I'm not talking about going out there and killing them and being a lynch mob. I'm saying is, those judges run them out of town on a rail in terms of making sure they never get reelected again. If they're elected for life, then throw out the legislators who put them in there or have them impeached. There's laws that you could do. I mean, there's recourses that you can use in this country to have overturned that. You see what I'm saying? But we just let it happen because we don't fight for righteousness. And I'm telling you, the old saying, you've heard it 1,000 times probably, the only thing needed for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. You know, instead of standing up against these people, they're just running roughshod all over us. This is what's happening to us. See what I'm saying? So that's why when God says, you go in there, And if you can't make peace with these people, man, then you're to slaughter them. You can keep the women and the children and the booty, but the men have got to go, because these are the leaders. They're the ones who are basically responsible for their opposition against God. That's basically what this is telling us here, all right? When you have women and children, he's going to give a little bit more insight of what you do with these women. But at the same token, with a child, okay, you can fashion and form his mind in such a way that you can turn his heart to God. In other words, I think it was Lenin who once said, give me the children from the time they were born to they reach age 7, and the seed that I've planted will never be uprooted. In other words, children are still pliable, but once they're grown, they're set in their ways. And that's why God is, you know, saying that you get rid of these men, because they're going to be a snare to you. All right? This is the spiritual application he's making here. Anyway, he did say that this only applies to these nations that are outside of Cana, because all the nations that were in Cana, they had to utterly destroy. Because why? Because of their wickedness. God was bringing judgment upon them. And God knew, if you don't destroy these people utterly and totally and completely, they're going to become a snare to you. They're going to become cinders in your eyes. They're going to become thorn in your sides. They're going to trip you up, and you're going to end up like them in terms of copying their pagan practices. And it's going to bring you down, which of course it did. Anybody have anything to add or share before we go any further? In verse 19 it says, and when you besiege a city a long time and make war against it in order to capture it, you shall not destroy its trees by swinging an axe against them, for you may eat from them, and you shall not cut them down. For is the tree of the field a man that it should be besieged by you? Only the trees which you know are not fruit trees you shall destroy and cut down, that you may construct siege works against the city that is making war with you until it falls. Now he does give some more practical advice, and you wonder, well, what's the spiritual application here? But again, the practical advice is this: when you're going up against a city, you're going to besiege the city. Well, the custom of the day was that you would cut down all the trees and use them as siege work against the city to you know, get yourself over the wall, whatever. But he says, that's fine. Use whatever trees you want, but don't use the fruit trees, because there's fruit on them, and they'll sustain you. In other words, in the middle of this spiritual battle, there's a lot to be said with doing things with a lot of common sense. You ever hear this old saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater? Well, sometimes I think Christians in their zeal can overstep their bounds in what they attempt to do in terms of promoting the kingdom of Christ. I mean, when we're talking about fruit here, you go back to Galatians. What are the fruits of the Spirit? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, goodness, faithfulness, and self-control. These are the kind of things, all right, you need. In the midst of a spiritual battle, this is what you need. You need spiritual fruit. What is the spiritual fruit? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, goodness, faithfulness, self-control. That's the nine fruits of the Spirit. That's what we got to employ in this spiritual battle. Because our battle, our war, is not against flesh and blood, and we don't use fleshly means to fight this war. It's spiritual means, all right? This is what we use in this battle. And we're talking about this fruits of the Spirit. But that's what I'm saying. This application you make is all important. Like, you know, I would say this. Christians are wasting your time if they're going to try to do battle with the forces of darkness. Like I said, I don't care whether it's Hollywood, I don't care whether it's the ACLU, I don't care, whatever group it might be, it's got to be done through the Spirit. Because what does Paul say in Timothy? He says, not by power, not by might, but by my Spirit, says the Lord. That's what we do. It's by His Spirit. And the fruits of the Spirit are all important in the midst of the spiritual warfare. Anybody have anyone to add or share to this chapter 20 rather? Okay, I tell you what, let's quickly read this chapter 21, and we're going to go close for the evening, because it says in verse 1 in chapter 21, it says, if a slain person is found lying in the open country, in the land which the Lord your God gives you to possess, and it is not known who has struck him, then your elders and your judges shall go out and measure the distance to the cities which are around the slain one. And it shall be that the city which is nearest to the slain man, that is the elders of that city, shall take a heifer of the herd which has not been worked and which has not pulled in a yoke, and the elders of that city shall bring their heifer down to the valley with running water, which has not been plowed or sown, and shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priest and the sons of Levi shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to serve him and to bless in his name, in the name of the Lord, and every dispute and every assault shall be settled by them. And all the elders of that city which is nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. And they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it. Forgive thy people Israel, whom thou hast redeemed, O Lord, and do not place the guilt of the innocent blood in this midst of this people, Israel. And the blood guiltiness shall be forgiven them. So you shall remove the guilt of innocent blood from your midst when you do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. Now, here's another interesting law that's on the books here. And we read it, and we got to say, okay, what is God trying to say? What is the spiritual significance here? All right, this is what we deal with constantly. I mean, there's hardly a week goes by that we don't see on the news or read in the paper of someone's body being found somewhere, either floating in a river or being dumped somewhere. People are being killed left and right all over this country and can't find the murderer. You know what I'm saying? It's just part of our culture now, isn't it? I mean, it's just amazing how many people are getting killed today. I mean, the gang shooting and drive-by shootings and God knows how many other kind of killings that are going on. And then when they find a body, you bring in the best CSIs you can or whatever, and it doesn't mean you're going to find the guilty party. And even if they do find him, a lot of times he's going to get off free. And even if they find him guilty, you know, he's going to get, and he gets the death penalty. I mean, 25 years later, he's still sitting on a death row. So, I mean, our whole system is just broken down. I mean, because what's really happening here is that we have basically abandoned God's laws in our hearts, in our spirit, and what's happening now is all of life has just become cheapened. And I think that the thing that just put us over the top was in 1973 with Roe versus Wade, man. It was like when we started killing children in the womb, unborn children, it just completely devalued life all over the place. Well, what God was trying to instill in these people is a real value for life. I mean, when they found a dead body, it wasn't, oh, yawn, ho, hum, what do we do now? You know what I mean? This is the procedure God gave them. He says, okay, if you find a body, you don't know who did this dastardly deed, then wherever that body is, you got to look around and find out where the closest city is. Wherever the closest city is, you go over there, you get these elders out there, and you have the elders get a heifer. And a heifer is a young cow. Okay, it's a female cow. Okay, obviously, cow's a female, but it's not a bull. And you bring it down to the valley closest to where the person was slain, where there's some running water. And then there you break that heifer's neck, and there the elders of the city take, wash their hands over this heifer, showing very graphically that we don't know who did this, but we wash our hands of the blood of this person. Now, here's what's interesting. The Bible says, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. All right? Now, here's a sacrifice here that's really unique, because, first of all, this animal is not, they don't slit its throat. There's not a drop of blood spilled. What do they do to it? They break its neck. What the suggestion is to me in a spiritual sense is that, okay, without the shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness of sins. So there's somebody running around out there that is guilty. And God is not going to let this guilty one go free. All right? He's not under the blood. But an animal has died in a place of the murderer, in a sense that he's going to take away the guilt, the collective guilt of the city. Otherwise, God is going to lay it at the feet of the city. You see? So it's like the city is washing their hands of the guilt of this murdered person. But the animal is not slain in the sense that his blood is not shed. All right? It's a very unique sacrifice, because all the other sacrifices, with the exception of the red heifer that we read in Numbers 19, all the other sacrifices had to be sacrificed down there at the temple area. Well, this one, you take a heifer over to where, the person was slain. The closest place where they have some running water, you break its neck there. All right. The heifer, I think it's kind of significant because most animal sacrifices were male. A heifer is a female. A female kind of suggests the bearer of life because women are the life bearers. All right. So this heifer is bearing this life in a sense that when you go back to the law, life for life, eye for eye, bone for bone, tooth for tooth, break for break, that type of thing. You know, life for life. All right. Well, this life bearer is now killed to take away the collective guilt of the city. In other words, I know it's kind of convoluted to us when we look at this, but I think the spiritual application or suggestion is very powerful because look at what's happening to this country. And I'm just going to use abortion as an example because we're getting close now to 50 million unborn children that have been murdered in this country. All right. Now, here's the thing. You don't have to be an abortion doctor. You don't have to be in favor of quote-unquote pro-choice to have blood on your hands here, in a sense. I mean, how many times have I said, you know, over the years, over and over and over again, that God is going to judge this nation? Well, we're part of the nation. This is a collective guilt. And I'm telling you, our judgment is going to be severe. It is going to be severe. Because I look at what happened back in the Civil War. All right, God judged this nation because of the sins of slavery, right? Over 600,000 people lost their lives, and it was Abraham Lincoln who had enough spiritual insight to see that this was the hand of God. And he said, hey, for every stroke of the lash, it is going to have to be atoned for by the slash of a sword. You know, but he was right on. And I cringe when I think of what the judgments are coming upon this nation, because this nation has a collective guilt, because this nation will not stand up and overturn this wicked law. Sure, there's people. I just got a phone call tonight. I gave some more money tonight to the defense of the unborn. All right? And it's just a little bit I can do, you know, and a whole lot. All right? But I'm just thinking, man, where are people today? We as a nation need to stand up against every form of murder, all right? And we need to wash our hands of this guilt, but we have to do it in such a way that we show that we don't want any part of this, all right? And believe me, you can claim to be Christian from now till hell freezes over, but if you vote or if I vote for politicians that promote this, we got blood all over our hands. I just cannot see how that can happen. Even Pilate, you know, when he washes his hands and saying, hey, I washed my hands in the blood of this man, it didn't get him off the hook because Jesus himself said to him, the ones who gave them over to him, their sin was greater than Pilate's. In other words, Pilate still had sin, all right? But he couldn't wash that out any more than, you know, remember Shakespeare's Hamlet trying to wash out that spot, out damn spot, out like trying to wash that spot away. You can't wash your guilt away. We can't do that. You know, God's going to hold us responsible. He's going to hold us accountable. And I think that this law here, I think, says a lot. Like I said, it may seem really peculiar to us, but we always have to ask, what is our teacher trying to tell us? What is he trying to teach us? And he's trying to tell us, hey, man, murder is a very, very, very serious, grave offense in the eyes of Almighty God, and we are not to treat it lightly. And if a city does not deal with this properly, he's going to hold them responsible as a collective guilt. That's what I'm saying. I said over and over again, we are guilty. I'm not running around saying people are guilty, you're guilty, he's guilty, they're guilty. I'm saying we're guilty. As a nation, we are guilty before Almighty God of murdering 50 million unborn children. And man, I'm telling you, God's not going to let us get away with it. All right? Because we have not done what's absolutely necessary to protect these unborn children. And now look at how it's all spilled over into our general population. I mean, people just kill each other left and right. Well, instead, what you read here, you see that God values life very, very, you know, greatly here. Concluding that verse 9, so you shall remove the guilt of innocent blood from your midst when you do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. All right? But are we doing what's right? As a nation, no, we're not doing what's right. I mean, if we really did what do what's right, we would remove this guilt from us. But since we have this blood guiltness upon us, we are going to be punished for it.
John, yeah. If somebody's ever listening in the future or over the internet and has had an abortion and is hearing this condemnation.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I would just say this, okay? All right? If people have had abortion, that's not an unforgivable sin. All right? No way. There's unforgivable sins, which is a blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. But believe me, murder is not an unforgivable sin. Adultery, homosexuality, fornication, stealing, lying, cheating. Name a sin, pick your poison. It all can be forgiven if it's under the blood. But we got to quit kidding ourselves, okay? We got to quit doing this tap dance and just simply saying, well, you know, it's just a blob of protoplasm. It's just a fetus. We always use these semantics, all right? And I'm telling you, as far as God is concerned, it is a life. It is a human life. It is being created in His image and likeness. And I'm telling you, what these abortion doctors do, it's like they just, God is there creating this human being in His image and likeness in the darkness of the womb, and then somebody comes along and snatches it out of the hand and destroys it. Is that a sin or not? Any child with some common sense could see that's not right. You know what I'm saying? He says in verse 10, it says, and when you go out to battle against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands, and you take them away captive, and see among the captives a beautiful woman, and have a desire for her, and would take her as a wife for yourself, then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall also remove her clothes from her captivity, and shall remain in your house, and mourn for her father and her mother a full month, and after that you may go into her and be your husband, and she shall be your wife. And it shall be that if you are not pleased with her, then you shall let her go wherever she wishes, but you shall certainly not sell her for money, and you shall not mistreat her, because you have humbled her. Now, we read this, we say, what? This looks like, what is God saying here? Because it looks like God is condoning what's happening here. But again, look deeper, think deeper, because I think there's too many shallow thinkers today, there's too many fuzzy thinkers today who are just going to read like something like this, and if it doesn't go in one ear and out the other over their heads, you know, they're just going to fly off the handle without seeing what it's really saying. All right, stop and think for a minute, especially back in the days of Moses, or even today, in time of war. Very often what happens is when warriors go in and they capture a city, what do to the women?
Rape them.
They rape them. They pillage them. They, you know, they enslave them. They treat them with some of the most, you know, inhumane manner imaginable. And what God is really doing here, He's protecting the women. He's saying this: you go in and you capture a city, all right, and then you capture the women and the children. He says, this is the way you to treat the women. If you see a woman you want, you feel, man, she is really a knockout. I'd really like to have her. Well, God says, well, you can't just go up and rape that woman. No. You take her to your house. You know, you give her a whole month to mourn for her father and her mother. All right? And she's to shave her head and to trim her nails. In other words, this is symbolically showing that her old lifestyle, she's no longer going to have a part of it. That she has going to have basically a conversion. In other words, she's going to become a proselyte. And then he says, after a month, you can take her as your wife. All right? Then you can go in and have sexual relations with her. But then he says, and after you've made her your wife, if you find, hey man, this woman is just hell on wheels. I can't handle this woman. I don't want this woman. She's just nothing but a quarrelsome, contentious whole pack. I'm getting rid of her. God says, okay, you cannot treat her as a slave. You cannot sell her for money. You have to let her go where she wishes. All right? And here, again, I think it shows that, hey, if you take this to the spiritual level, all right, God doesn't force Himself upon anybody. If somebody, you know, decides that they want to become part of the, become a Christian, turn away from their old lifestyle, well, if they have a change of heart, you know, hey, you're free to go. Christ doesn't force Himself on anybody. He says in Revelations, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If you hear my voice, open the door and invite me in, I will sup with you and you with me. Okay, have fellowship with you. But it's all a matter of the person's sovereign will, what they want to do. All right. Like I said, you read this kind of stuff and you wonder, this doesn't seem right. From a Christian perspective, you know, thousands of years removed. But again, look at the big picture. Stand back and look at it and you see, you know what God is really doing here? He's really protecting women, because women, when they were overrun as far as their nation or their city by their enemies, do you think that the pagan nations showed this kind of respect for human beings? No way, man. No way. See what I'm saying? So it's actually a protection for the women. All right? And in verse 15, it says, if a man has two wives and one loved and the other unloved. Actually, does anybody's Bible say one loved and one hated? Okay, let me just qualify this, because I believe what it's saying is he loves one woman more than the other. He can love both women, but he loves one woman more than the other. And the reason I say this is because, remember what Jesus said? Unless you hate your mother and your father, your brother and sister, and your children, and even yourself, you cannot be my disciple. He said that in Luke 14, and I think he said it in Matthew, where basically saying our love for him must be supreme. Also, if you go back to the book of Genesis, it says that Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. But then almost the following verse, it says, and God saw that Leah was hated. Well, Leah wasn't hated, but what God saw was that Jacob's love for Leah was almost hate in comparison to his love for Rachel. He loved both women, but there was no comparison there. He really loved her, you know, intensely. There was no question about it. So what God is saying here is this. If a man has two wives and he loves one wife more than the other, and the one that he loves the least, put it that way, has a firstborn son, he can't alter, you know, the right of the firstborn. The right of the firstborn was a double inheritance. This is the way it worked. If a man had, let's say, for example, if he had five sons, well, the firstborn son, he was to get a double portion. In other words, the inheritance was to be divided instead of five ways, it was to be divided six ways. And the firstborn son was to get two-sixths of the inheritance. Now, this has spiritual application too, because if you go back to the book of Colossians, what are we told? That Jesus Christ is the visible image of the invisible God. He is the firstborn of all creation. And Jehovah's Witnesses take that and they run with it and they feel like, well, you know, see, Jesus is a created being. No, he's the firstborn of all creation, meaning this. He is the heir to all things. All right? You go back, I think it's in the book of Jeremiah, and God says, he referred to Ephraim as being his firstborn. Well, you go all the way back to the book of Genesis, and what do you read? Ephraim wasn't the firstborn. Who was the firstborn?
Reuben.
No. Of Joseph's kids.
Manasseh.
Manasseh and Ephraim. All right? But God said that Ephraim was his firstborn, even though Ephraim was secondborn. All right? Meaning this, as far as God was concerned, Ephraim was in a place of inheritance. All right, he was to get the double portion. If you look at a number of situations in the Bible, all right, the firstborn didn't always get the double portion. Who, for example, in Jacob's family didn't get it? He just mentioned it, huh? Reuben. Reuben did not get the double portion or the inheritance. Why?
Because he defiled the couch of his father.
Yeah, he slept with one of his concubines. So he forfeited his right as a firstborn. All right? Who else did it? It was Esau. Remember, he was a firstborn, but we are told in Hebrews, he despised his birthright. He sold his birthright for a mess of porridge. So he lost that privilege. Is that right? All right? And there's been others too. Look at David. How many brothers did David have? He had seven brothers. There's eight boys all together in that family. He was the last born. Okay, he was the youngest. But he was the one, you know, that came out on top. All right? My point is this. When God is trying to make a point about the firstborn, it has everything to do with inheritance, and it really has this culmination in Jesus Christ, because this is our tutor. What are they trying to teach us? How is it pointing to Jesus Christ? Well, Jesus Christ is the firstborn of all creation. All right? And nothing can change that. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Whether you like it or not. All right, that has to be, that's set in stone. See, that's what this is telling us here. You can't say, well, if a husband has two wives and he loves one more than the other, and the one he loves the least has the firstborn son, you can't change that. Okay, we can't change the situation where God has ordained it as far as Jesus Christ being the firstborn of all creation. He's the heir of all things. See what I'm saying? All right, that's what it's pointing to here as far as the firstborn. But you can go through examples in scriptures and see how the firstborn has forfeited, you know, their double portion. But here again, just so people don't become such shallow thinkers, you got to ask yourself, okay, what else involved the firstborn? Well, it wasn't just simply a privilege, it was a tremendous responsibility, because the firstborn, one of the reasons why he got a double portion was that he had to take care of his parents. So there was a lot of responsibility there. I was the firstborn son in my family. All right, my sister is less than a year older than I am, but what I'm saying, I'm the firstborn son, you know. But I have four other brothers, and you know what I discovered early on that, hey, my brothers always followed in my footsteps. And when I was going down the wrong road, they were following me. And when I got my act together and got back on the right road, they followed me. It's a tremendous responsibility that you have before God as a firstborn. Anyway, anybody have anything you want to add or share on that? Okay, let's pick up verse 18, I guess. It says, if any man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father or his mother, or when they chasten him, he will not even listen to them, then his father and his mother shall seize him and bring him out to the elders of the city at the gateway of his hometown. And they shall say to the elders of the city, this son of ours is a stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death. So you shall remove the evil from your midst, and all of Israel shall hear it and fear. Man, look at that. Look at this law in this book. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, you will not find anything in the Old Testament or the New Testament where this had a fulfillment. In other words, there's no example of any parent doing this, all right? But here's a couple of interesting things about this, okay? First of all, we just read it, I think, a few chapters back, that you had to have two witnesses here. If one parent came up and said, hey, this is a worthless bum, and the other parent says, no, he's a great kid, well, then you couldn't do anything about that. But you had to have two witnesses. That was paramount to having that. But what we read the other night, the two witnesses against somebody who was to be executed, they were the first ones to have to do what?
They were the first ones
to throw the first stone. But look what's kind of interesting here. I think God, recognizes that he doesn't want to put parents in this position where they have to throw the first stone. Instead, who's going to be throwing the first stone? It's the elders of the cities, not the parents. But the parents are the ones that are witnessing against it. So what is our tutor telling us? What is it teaching us? Because this is very, very important, and it has a spiritual application today. You know, nothing's changed, okay? We don't go around killing rebellious kids. But here's the thing. If you've got a rebellious kid, that he's stubborn. I mean, when you read this here, he says he's a glutton and a drunkard. How many parents today have kids that are drug addicts? And because they're drug addicts, what do? They live a life of crime, and they don't work, they don't show any responsibility. If they come into your house, man, you've got to have everything nailed down, because they'll steal from you. They'll steal from their own parents. They'll rip them off. They'll do anything to feed their habits, right? Now, that is a rebellious, worthless kid, isn't it? And the parents could just throw their hands up and say, this kid is absolutely incorrigible. Well, it could have happened back in the days of Moses. So God says, okay, if this is the situation with this kid, if he's so unruly, if he's so undisciplined, you can't do anything, then you drag him to the elders of the community, of the city. You tell them what's going on, and they'll stone him to death. And you know what that's going to do? We read it right here. What is it going to do? Verse 21, then all the men of the city shall stone him to death, so that you shall remove the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear it in fear. It acts as a deterrent, right? But here's the thing. I think it's so important. There's laws in the books where God said, hey, if you curse your mother and father, you are to be stoned to death. If you struck your mother or father, you are to be stoned to death. Man, those are heavy laws, right? All right, we don't do that today, but it had its fulfillment in Christ as far as the law. But what was our tutor trying to tell us?
Respecting the God-given authorities over you.
Yeah, your parents stand in the place of God, all right? I've heard of stories, and I've known people who've actually punched out their dad. I mean, they may boast about that, like, hey, I beat my dad up. I almost feel like beating them up. Okay, what's wrong with you? You know what I mean? Don't you realize you take a swing at your dad, you're taking a swing at God in a spiritual sense? You got to show disrespect. Now, it doesn't mean, hey, we need to honor our parents, but it doesn't mean we have to always agree with our parents, and even in some cases, we don't always have to obey our parents. If our parents say, hey, come on, rob this bank with me, you know, you can say, hey, man, I'm not going to put your lights out, but I'm telling you right now, I'm not going to do this because God comes first in my life. That's what Jesus meant when he says, unless you hate your mother and your father and your brother and your sister and so on and so forth, you cannot be my disciple. In other words, hey, God comes first. I can't do this because it violates my conscience and against what God has said. He comes first, not you. See, that's putting God first. But see, a parent who really loves their child, they're going to have the child's best interests at heart. That doesn't mean they're perfect. They make mistakes. I mean, my dad really made a lot of mistakes with me. But I tell you what, I honor my dad. I still look at that man and I thank God for him, right? Because I know he's a good man. And he stands in the place of God. And when you read stuff like this, you just say, okay, your parents don't have to be perfect. All right, but you really need to honor them, and you don't always have to agree with them, and in certain cases you don't always have to obey them. but you always have to respect them because they are in the place of God.
Anyway, last couple of verses, in verse 22, he says, and if a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he is put to death, you hang him on a tree, his corpse shall not hang all night on a tree, but you shall surely bury him on the same day, for he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile your land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. Here's another, I think, really insightful thing. When Moses wrote this, this was centuries before crucifixion was even invented. But look what Paul is the one who quotes this, and he quotes it again in Galatians 3. He says this, however, the law is not of faith. On the contrary, he who practices them shall live by them. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is every one who hangs on a tree. What are we reading over here? Look what it says here. Verse 22, and if a man has committed a sin worthy of death and is put to death, you are to hang him on a tree. His corpse shall not hang on all night on the tree, but you shall surely bury him on the same day. For he who is hanged is accursed of God. But here, Paul tells us in the New Testament, he says that Jesus Christ was hung on a tree, taking on the curse of God on himself for us. That's why we put our faith in him. We no longer have to hang on a tree ourselves, you see what I'm saying, for our own sins. You see, that's what I'm saying. When you read the Old Testament here, especially when you're going through Numbers, Deuteronomy, and Leviticus and stuff like that, people, a lot of Christians are just intimidated by it. They ignore it. They don't want to read it because they feel like, hey, man, it has nothing to say to me. I'm telling you, this has plenty to say to us today. We always just got to ask, how does this point to Jesus Christ? And what is our tutor? What is the law telling us today? Because I'm telling you, all the principles are still in effect. All right? Even though the law is no longer in effect, as far as the ceremonial laws, they had this fulfillment in Christ, but the principles are still in effect. I mean, if you've got an unruly kid, you don't go out there and get the elders of the church and stone them to death, okay? But the principle's still in effect, you see? Anybody have anything you want to add or share?